This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Hoot by Carl Hiaasen, read for you by Chad Lowe. One. Roy would not have noticed the strange boy if it weren't for Dana Matherson, because Roy ordinarily didn't look out the window of the school bus. He preferred to read comics and mystery books on the morning ride to Trace Middle. But on this day, a Monday Roy would never forget, Dana Matherson grabbed Roy's head from behind and pressed his thumbs into Roy's temple, as if he were squeezing a soccer ball. The older kids were supposed to stay in the back of the bus, but Dana had snuck up behind Roy's seat and ambushed him. When Roy tried to wriggle free, Dana mushed his face against the window. It was then, squinting through the smudged glass, that Roy spotted the strange boy running along the sidewalk. It appeared as if he was hurrying to catch the school bus, which had stopped at a corner to pick up more kids. The boy was straw blonde and wiry, and his skin was nut brown from the sun. The expression on his face was intent and serious. He wore a faded Miami Heat basketball jersey and dirty khaki shorts. And here was the odd part. No shoes. The soles of his bare feet looked as black as barbecue coals. Trace Middle School didn't have the world's strictest dress code, but Roy was pretty sure that some sort of footwear was required. The boy might have been carrying sneakers in his backpack, if only he'd been wearing a backpack. No shoes, no backpack, no books. Strange indeed, on a school day. Roy was sure that the barefoot boy would catch all kinds of grief from Dana and the other big kids once he boarded the bus. But that didn't happen. Because the boy kept running, past the corner, past the line of students waiting to get on the bus, past the bus itself. Roy wanted to shout, "Hey, look at that guy!" But his mouth wasn't working so well. Dana Matherson still had him from behind, pushing his face against the window. As the bus pulled away from the intersection, Roy hoped to catch another glimpse of the boy farther up the street. However, he had turned off the sidewalk and was now cutting across a private yard, running very fast, much faster than Roy could run, and maybe even faster than Richard, Roy's best friend back in Montana. Richard was so fast that he got to work out with the high school track squad when he was only in seventh grade. Dana Matherson was digging his fingernails into Roy's scalp, trying to make him squeal, but Roy barely felt a thing. He was gripped with curiosity as the running boy dashed through one neat green yard after another, getting smaller in Roy's vision as he put a wider distance between himself and the school bus. Roy saw a big pointy-eared dog, probably a German shepherd, bound off somebody's porch and go for the boy. Incredibly, the boy didn't change his course. He vaulted over the dog, crashed through a cherry hedge, and then disappeared from view. Roy gasped. "What's the matter, cowgirl? Had enough?" This was Dana, hissing in Roy's right ear. Being the new kid on the bus, Roy didn't expect any help from the others. The cowgirl remark was so lame, it wasn't worth getting mad about. Dana was a well-known idiot, on top of which he outweighed Roy by at least 50 pounds. Fighting back would have been a complete waste of energy. "Had enough yet? We can't hear you, Tex." Dana's breath smelled like stale cigarettes. Smoking and beating up smaller kids were his two main hobbies.
"Yeah, okay," Roy said impatiently. "I've had enough."
As soon as he was freed, Roy lowered the window and stuck out his head. The strange boy was gone. Who was he? What was he running from? Roy wondered if any of the other kids in the bus had seen what he'd seen. For a moment, he wondered if he'd really seen it himself. That same morning, a police officer named David Delinko was sent to the future site of another Mother Paula's All-American Pancake House. It was a vacant lot at the corner of East Oriole and Woodbury, on the eastern edge of town. Officer Delenko was met by a man in a dark blue pickup truck. The man, who was as bald as a beach ball, introduced himself as Curly. Officer Delenko thought the bald man must have a good sense of humor to go by such a nickname. But he was wrong. Curly was cranky and unsmiling.
"You should see what they done," he said to the policeman.
"Who?"
"Follow me," the man called Curly said.
Officer Delenko got in step behind him. "The dispatcher said you wanted to report some vandalism?"
"That's right,"
Curly grunted over his shoulder. The policeman couldn't see what there was to be vandalized in the property, which was basically a few acres of scraggly weeds. Curly stopped walking and pointed at a short piece of lumber on the ground. A ribbon of bright pink plastic was tied to one end of the stick. The other end was sharpened and caked with gray dirt.
Curly said, "They pulled him out."
"That's a survey stake?" asked Officer Delenko.
"Yep, they yanked him out of the ground, every damn one."
"Probably just kids."
"And then they threw him every which way,"
Curly said, waving a beefy arm.
"And then they filled in the holes."
"That's a little weird," the policeman remarked. "When did this happen?"
"Last night or early this morning," Curly said. "Maybe it don't look like a big deal, but it's going to take a while to get the site marked out again. Meantime, we can't start clearing or grading or nothing. We got backhoes and dozers already leased, and now they got to sit. I know it don't look like the crime of the century, but still."
"I understand," said Officer Delenko. "What's your estimate of the monetary damage?"
"Damage?"
"Yes, so I can put it in my report." The policeman picked up the survey stake and examined it. "It's not really broken, is it?"
"Well, no."
"Were any of them destroyed?" asked Officer Delenko. "How much does one of these things cost? A buck or two?" The man called Curly was losing his patience.
"They didn't break none of the stakes," he said gruffly.
"Not even one?" The policeman frowned. He was trying to figure out what to put in his report. You can't have vandalism without monetary damages, and if nothing on the property was broken or defaced...
"What I'm trying to explain," Curly said irritably, "it's not that they messed up the survey stakes. It's them screwing up our whole construction schedule. That's where it'll cost some serious bucks."
Officer Delenko took off his cap and scratched his head. "Let me think on this," he said. Walking back to the patrol car, the policeman stumbled and fell down. Curly grabbed him under one arm and hoisted him to his feet. Both men were mildly embarrassed.
"Stupid owls," said Curly.
The policeman brushed the dirt and grass burrs off his uniform.
"You say owls?"
Curly gestured at a hole in the ground. It was as big around as one of Mother Paula's famous buttermilk flapjacks. A mound of loose white sand was visible at the entrance.
"That's what you tripped over," Curly informed Officer Delenko.
"An owl lives down there?"
The policeman bent over and studied the hole.
"How big are they?"
"About as tall as a beer can."
"No kidding," said Officer Delenko.
"But I ain't never seen one, officially speaking."
Back at the patrol car, the patrolman took out his clipboard and started writing the report. It turned out that Curly's real name was Leroy Brannett, and he was the supervising engineer of the construction project. He scowled when he saw the policeman write down foreman instead. Officer Delenko explained to Curly the problem with filing the complaint as a vandalism.
"My sergeant's gonna kick it back down to me because technically nothing really got vandalized. Some kids came on the property and pulled a bunch of sticks out of the ground." "How do you know it was kids?" Curly muttered.
"Well, who else would it be?"
"What about them filling up the holes and throwing the stakes, just to make us lay out the whole site all over again? What about that?"
It puzzled the policeman, too. Kids usually don't go to that kind of trouble when pulling a prank. "Do you have any particular suspects?" Curly admitted he didn't.
"But okay, say it was kids. That means it's not a crime?"
"Of course it's a crime," Officer Delenko replied. "I'm saying it's not technically vandalism. It's trespassing and malicious mischief."
"That'll do," Curly said with a shrug. "Long as I can get a copy of your report for the insurance company, at least we'll be covered for lost time and expenses."
Officer Delenko gave Curly a card with the address of the police department's administration office and the name of the clerk in charge of filing the incident reports. Curly tucked the card into the breast pocket of his foreman's shirt. The policeman put on his sunglasses and slid into his patrol car, which was as hot as a brick oven. He quickly turned on the ignition and cranked the air conditioner up full blast. As he buckled his seatbelt, he said, "Mr. Brannett, there's one more thing I wanted to ask. I'm just curious."
"Fire away," said Curly, wiping his brow with a yellow bandana.
"It's about those owls."
"Sure."
"What's going to happen to them?" Officer Delenko asked. "Once you start bulldozing, I mean." Curly the foreman chuckled. He thought the policeman must be kidding.
"What owls?" he said.
All day long, Roy couldn't stop thinking about the strange running boy. Between classes, he scanned the faces in the hallways on the chance that the boy had come to school late. Maybe he'd been hurrying home, Roy thought, to change clothes and put on some shoes. But Roy didn't see any kids who resembled the one who had jumped over the big pointy-eared dog. Maybe he's still running, Roy thought as he ate lunch. Florida was made for running. Roy had never seen any place so flat. Back in Montana, you had steep, craggy mountains that rose 10,000 feet into the clouds. Here, the only hills were man-made highway bridges, smooth, gentle slopes of concrete. Then Roy remembered the heat and the humidity, which on some days seemed to suck the very meat out of his lungs. A long run in the Florida sun would be torture, he thought. A kid would have to be tough as nails to make a routine of that. A boy named Garrett sat down across from Roy. Roy nodded high, and Garrett nodded high, and then both of them went back to eating the gooey macaroni on their lunch trays. Being the new kid, Roy always sat alone at the end of the table whenever he was in the cafeteria. Roy was an old pro at being the new kid. Trace Middle was the sixth school he had attended since he started going to school. Coconut Cove was the 10th town his family had lived in since Roy could remember. Roy's father worked for the government. His mother said they moved so often because Roy's father was very good at his job, whatever that was, and frequently got promoted. Apparently, that's how the government awarded good work, by transferring you from one place to another.
"Hey," said Garrett, "you got a skateboard?"
"No, but I got a snowboard."
Garrett hooted.
"What for?"
"Where I used to live, it snowed a lot," Roy said.
"You should learn to skateboard. It's awesome, man."
"Oh, I know how to skateboard. I just don't have one."
"Then you should get one," Garrett said. "Me and my friends, we do the major malls. You should come."
"That'd be cool." Roy tried to sound enthusiastic. He didn't like shopping malls, but he appreciated that Garrett was trying to be friendly. Garrett was a D student, but he was popular in school because he goofed around in class and made farting noises whenever a teacher called him out. Garrett was the king of phony farts at Trace Middle. His most famous trick was farting out the first line of the Pledge of Allegiance during homeroom. Ironically, Garrett's mother was a guidance counselor at Trace Middle. Roy figured she used up all her guiding skills every day at school and was too worn out to deal with Garrett when she got home.
"Yeah, we skate hard until the security guards run us off," Garrett was saying. "And then we do the parking lots until we get chased out of there, too. It's a blast."
"Sweet," Roy said, though cruising a mall seemed like a pretty dull way to spend a Saturday morning. He was looking forward to his first airboat ride in the Everglades. His dad had promised to take him one of these weekends.
"Are there any other schools around here?"
Roy asked Garrett.
"Why, you sick of this one already?"
Garrett cackled and plunged a spoon into a lump of clammy apple crisp.
"No way. The reason I asked, I saw this weird kid today at one of the bus stops, except he didn't get on the bus, and he's not here at school," Roy said. "So I figured he must not go to Trace."
"I don't know anyone who doesn't go to Trace," Garrett said.
"There's a Catholic school up in Fort Myers, but that's a long ways off.
Was he wearing uniform, this kid?
Because the nuns make everybody wear uniforms."
"No, he definitely wasn't in a uniform."
"You're sure he was in middle school? Maybe he goes to Graham," Garrett suggested.
Graham was the public high school nearest to Coconut Cove.
Roy said, "He didn't look big enough for high school."
"Maybe he was a midget."
Garrett grinned and made a farty noise with one of his cheeks.
"I don't think so," said Roy.
"You said he was weird."
"He wasn't wearing any shoes," Roy said, "and he was running like crazy."
"Maybe somebody was after him. Did he look scared?"
Not really. Garrett nodded. High school kid. Bet you $5.
To Roy, that still didn't make sense. Classes at Graham High started 55 minutes earlier than the classes at Trace. The high school kids were off the streets long before the middle school buses finished their routes.
So he was skipping class. Kids skip all the time, Garrett said. You want your dessert?
Roy pushed his tray across the table.
You ever skip school?
Yeah, Garrett said sarcastically. Bunch of times.
You ever skip alone?
Garrett thought for a moment.
No, it's always me and my friends.
See, that's what I mean.
So maybe the kid's just a psycho. Who cares?
Or an outlaw, said Roy.
Garrett looked skeptical. An outlaw? You mean like Jesse James?
No, not exactly, Roy said, though there had been something wild in that kid's eyes.
Garrett laughed again. An outlaw? That's rich, Eberhardt. You got a seriously whacked imagination.
Yeah, said Roy, but already he was thinking about a plan. He was determined to find the running boy.
2. The next morning, Roy traded seats on the school bus to be closer to the front door. When the bus turned onto the street where he had seen the running boy, Roy slipped his backpack over his shoulders and scouted out the window, waiting. 7 rows back, Dana Matherson was tormenting a 6th grader named Lewis. Lewis was from Haiti, and Dana was merciless. As the bus came to a stop at the intersection, Roy poked his head out the window and checked up and down the street. Nobody was running. 7 kids boarded the bus, but the strange, shoeless boy was not among them. It was the same story the next day, and the day after that. By Friday, Roy had pretty much given up. He was sitting 10 rows from the front door, reading an X-Men comic, as the bus turned the familiar corner and began to slow down. A movement at the corner of his eye made Roy glance up from his comic book, and there he was on the sidewalk, running again. Same basketball jersey, same grimy shorts, same black-soled feet. As the brakes of the school bus wheezed, Roy grabbed his backpack off the floor and stood up. At that instant, 2 big sweaty hands closed around his neck.
"Where are you going, cowgirl?"
"Let me go,"
Roy rasped, squirming to break free. The grip on his throat tightened. He felt Dana's ashtray breath on his right ear.
"How come you don't got your boots on today? Whoever heard of a cowgirl wearing Air Jordans?"
"They're Reeboks," Roy squeaked.
The bus had stopped and the students were starting to board. Roy was furious. He had to get to the door fast before the driver closed it and the bus began to roll. But Dana wouldn't let go, digging his fingers into Roy's windpipe. Roy was having trouble getting air, and struggling only made it worse.
"Look at you," Dana chortled from behind. "Red as a tomato."
Roy knew the rules against fighting on the bus, but he couldn't think of anything else to do. He clenched his right fist and brought it up blindly over his shoulder, as hard as he could. The punch landed on something moist and rubbery. There was a gargled cry, then Dana's hands fell away from Roy's neck. Panting, Roy bolted for the door of the bus just as the last student, a tall girl with curly blonde hair and red-framed eyeglasses, came up the steps. Roy clumsily edged past her and jumped to the ground.
"Where do you think you're going?" the girl demanded.
"Hey, wait!"
the bus driver shouted, but Roy was already a blur. The running boy was way ahead of him, but Roy figured he could stay close enough to keep him in sight. He knew the kid couldn't go at full speed forever. He followed him for several blocks, over fences, through shrubbery, weaving through yapping dogs and lawn sprinklers and hot tubs. Eventually, Roy felt himself tiring. "This kid is amazing," he thought. "Maybe he's practicing for the track team." Once, Roy thought he saw the boy glance over his shoulder, as if he knew he was being pursued, but Roy couldn't be certain. The boy was still far ahead of him, and Roy was gulping like a beached trout. His shirt was soaked, and perspiration poured off his forehead, stinging his eyes. The last house in the subdivision was still under construction, but the shoeless boy dashed heedlessly through the lumber and loose nails. 3 men hanging drywall stopped to holler at him, but the boy never broke stride.
One of the same workers made a one-armed lunge at Roy, but missed. Suddenly, there was grass under his feet again, the greenest, softest grass that Roy had ever seen. He realized that he was on a golf course, and that the blonde kid was tearing down the middle of a long, lush fairway. On one side was a row of tall Australian pines, and on the other side was a milky, man-made lake. Roy could see four brightly dressed figures ahead, gesturing at the barefoot boy as he ran by. Roy gritted his teeth and kept going. His legs felt like wet cement, and his lungs were on fire. 100 yards ahead, the boy cut sharply to the right and disappeared into the pine trees. Roy doggedly aimed himself for the woods. An angry shout echoed, and Roy noticed that the people in the fairway were waving their arms at him, too. He kept right on running. Moments later, there was a distant glint of sunlight on metal, followed by a muted thwack. Roy didn't actually see the golf ball until it came down 6 feet in front of him. He had no time to duck or dive out of the way. All he could do was turn his head and brace for the blow. The bounce caught him squarely above the left ear, and at first it didn't even hurt. Then Roy felt himself swaying and spinning as a brilliant gout of fireworks erupted inside his skull. He felt himself falling for what seemed like a long time, falling as softly as a drop of rain on velvet. When the golfers ran up and saw Roy face down in the sand trap, they thought he was dead. Roy heard their frantic cries, but he didn't move. The sugar-white sand felt cool against his burning cheeks, and he was very sleepy. The cowgirl jab? Well, that was my own fault, he thought. He'd told the kids at school he was from Montana, cattle country, when in fact he'd been born in Detroit, Michigan. Roy's mother and father had moved away from Detroit when he was only a baby, so it seemed silly to call it his hometown. In Roy's mind, he didn't really have a hometown. His family had never stayed anywhere long enough for Roy to feel settled. Of all the places the Eberharts had lived, Roy's favorite was Bozeman, Montana. The snaggle-peaked mountains, the braided green rivers, the sky so blue it seemed like a painting. Roy had never imagined anywhere so beautiful. The Eberharts stayed 2 years, 7 months, and 11 days. Roy wanted to stay forever. On the night his father announced they'd be moving to Florida, Roy locked himself in his bedroom and cried. His mother caught him climbing out the window with his snowboard and a plastic tackle box, in which he had packed underwear, socks, a fleece ski jacket, and $100 savings bond his grandfather had given him as a birthday present. His mother assured Roy that he would love Florida. "Everybody in America wants to move there," she said. "It's so sunny and gorgeous." Then Roy's father had poked his head in the door and said, with somewhat forced enthusiasm, "And don't forget Disney World." "Disney World is an armpit," Roy had stated flatly, "compared to Montana. I want to stay here." As usual, he was outvoted. So when the homeroom teacher at Trace Middle asked the new kid where he was from, he stood up and proudly said, "Bozeman, Montana." It was the same answer he gave on the school bus when Dana Matherson accosted him on the first day. And from then on, Roy was Tex, or Cowgirl, or Roy Rogers Heart. It was his own fault for not saying Detroit. "Why did you punch Mr. Matherson?" asked Viola Hennepin. She was the vice principal of Trace Middle, and it was in her dim office cubicle that Roy now sat, awaiting justice. "Because he was choking me to death?" "That's not Mr. Matherson's version of events, Mr. Eberhardt." Miss Hennepin's face had extremely pointy features. She was tall and bony and wore a perpetually severe expression. "He says your attack was unprovoked." "Right," said Roy. "I always pick the biggest, meanest kid on the bus and punch him in the face just for fun." "We don't appreciate sarcasm here at Trace Middle," said Miss Hennepin. "Are you aware that you broke his nose? Don't be surprised if your parents get a hospital bill in the mail." Roy said, "The dumb jerk almost strangled me." "Really? Your bus driver, Mr. Kesey, said he didn't see a thing." "It's possible he was actually watching the road," Roy said. Miss Hennepin smiled thinly. "You've got quite the snippy attitude, Mr. Eberhardt. What do you think ought to be done with a violent boy like you?"
Matherson is the menace. He hassles all the smaller kids on the bus.
Nobody else has complained.
Because they're scared of him, Roy said, which was also why none of the other kids had backed up his story. Nobody wanted to narc on Dana and have to face him the next day on the bus.
If you did nothing wrong, then why did you run away? Miss Hennepin asked.
Roy noticed a single jet black hair sprouting above her upper lip. He wondered why Miss Hennepin hadn't removed the hair. Was it possible that she was letting it grow?
Mr. Eberhardt, I asked you a question.
I ran because I was scared of him too, Roy replied.
Or perhaps you were scared of what would happen to you when the incident was reported.
That's totally not true.
Under the rules, said Miss Hennepin, you could be suspended from school.
He was choking me. What else was I supposed to do?
Stand up, please.
Roy did what he was told.
Step closer, Miss Hennepin said. How does your head feel? Is this where the golf ball hit you?
She touched the tender purple lump above his ear.
Yes, ma'am.
You're a lucky young man. It could have been worse.
He felt Miss Hennepin's bony fingers turn down the collar of his shirt. Her chilly gray eyes narrowed, and her waxy lips pursed in consternation.
Hmm,
she said, peering like a buzzard.
What is it? Roy backed out of her reach.
The vice principal cleared her throat and said, That knot on your head tells me you've learned your lesson the hard way. Am I right?
Roy nodded. There was no use trying to reason with a person who was cultivating one long, oily hair on her lip.
Miss Hennepin gave Roy the creeps.
Therefore, I've decided not to suspend you from school, she said, tapping a pencil on her chin. I am, however, going to suspend you from the bus.
Really?
Roy almost burst out laughing. What a fantastic punishment. No bus ride? No Dana?
For 2 weeks, Miss Hennepin said.
Roy tried to look bummed.
2 whole weeks? In addition, I want you to write a letter of apology to Mr. Matherson.
A sincere letter.
Okay, said Roy. But who's going to help him read it?
Miss Hennepin clicked her pointy yellow teeth.
Don't press your luck, Mr. Eberhardt.
No, ma'am.
As soon as he left the office, Roy hurried to the boys' bathroom. He climbed up on one of the sinks that had a mirror and pulled down his shirt collar to see what Miss Hennepin had been staring at. Roy grinned. Plainly visible on each side of his Adam's apple were 4 finger-sized bruises. He swiveled around on the rim of the sink and, craning over his shoulder, spotted 2 matching thumb marks on the nape of his neck.
Thank you, dumb butt Dana, he thought. Now Miss Hennepin knows I'm telling the truth.
Well, most of the truth. Roy had left out the part about the strange running boy. He wasn't sure why, but it seemed like the sort of thing you didn't tell a vice principal unless you absolutely had to. He had missed his morning classes and most of lunch hour. He hurried through the cafeteria line and found an empty table. Sitting with his back to the doors, he wolfed down a chili burger and a carton of lukewarm milk. Dessert was an overbaked chocolate chip cookie the size of a hockey puck, and just about as tasty.
Gross, he muttered.
The inedible cookie made a thud when it landed on the plate. Roy picked up his tray and rose to leave. He jumped when a hand landed forcefully on his shoulder. He was afraid to look. What if it was Dana Matherson? The perfect ending, Roy thought gloomily, to a perfectly terrible day.
Sit down, said a voice behind him. Definitely not Dana's.
Roy brushed the hand off his shoulder and turned. Standing there, arms folded, was the tall blonde girl with the red-framed eyeglasses, the one he'd encountered on the school bus. The girl looked extremely unhappy.
You nearly knocked me down this morning, she said.
Sorry.
Why were you running?
No reason.
Roy tried to get past her, but this time she sidestepped in front of him, blocking his path.
You could have really hurt me, she said. Roy felt uncomfortable being confronted by a girl. It wasn't a scene you wanted the other boys to see, for sure. Worse, Roy was truly intimidated. The curly-haired girl was taller than he was, with wide shoulders and tan, muscular legs. She looked like an athlete. Soccer, probably, or volleyball. He said,
See, I punched a kid in the nose.
Oh, I heard all about it, the girl said snidely. But that's not why you ran off, was it?
Sure it was. Roy wondered if she was going to accuse him of something else, like stealing the lunch money out of her backpack.
You're lying.
The girl boldly seized the other side of his lunch tray to prevent him from leaving.
Let go, Roy said sharply. I'm late.
Take it easy. There's 6 minutes to the bell, cowgirl. She looked as if she wouldn't mind socking him in the stomach.
Now tell the truth. You were chasing somebody, weren't you?
Roy felt relieved that he wasn't being blamed for a serious crime.
Did you see him too? That kid with no shoes?
Still gripping Roy's tray, the girl took a step forward, backing Roy up.
I got some advice for you, she said, lowering her voice.
Roy glanced around anxiously. They were the only ones left in the cafeteria.
You listening?
The girl shoved him once more.
Yeah? Good.
She didn't stop pushing until she had Roy pinned to the wall with his lunch tray. Glaring balefully over the top of her red-framed eyeglasses, she said,
From now on, mind your own damn business.
Roy was scared, he had to admit. The edge of the tray was digging into his ribcage. This girl was a bruiser.
You saw that kid too, didn't you?
He whispered.
I don't know what you're talking about. Mind your own business if you know what's good for you.
She let go of Roy's tray and spun on her heels.
Wait!
Roy called after her.
Who is he?
But the curly-haired girl didn't answer or even look back. Stalking off, she simply raised her right arm and reproachfully wagged a forefinger in the air. 3. Officer Delinko shielded his eyes against the noon glare.
Took you long enough, said Curly, the construction foreman.
There was a four-car pileup north of town, the police officer explained, with injuries. Curly huffed. Whatever. Anyways, you can see what they done.
Again, the trespassers had methodically removed every survey marker and filled in the stake holes. Officer Delinko wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he was beginning to suspect that this wasn't the random work of juvenile pranksters. Perhaps somebody had a grudge against Mother Paula and her world-famous pancakes.
This time you got an actual vandalism to report, Curly said pointedly. This time they messed up some private property.
He led Officer Delinko to the southwest corner of the site, where a flatbed truck was parked. All four tires were flat. Curly raised the palm of his hands and said,
There you go. Each of them tires is worth $150.
What happened? The policeman asked.
The sidewalls was slashed.
Curly's shiny head bobbed in indignation. Officer Delinko knelt down and studied the truck's tires. He couldn't see any knife marks in the rubber.
I think somebody just let the air out, he said.
Curly muttered a reply that was difficult to hear.
I'll make a report anyway, the policeman promised.
How about this? Curly said. How about you put some extra patrols around here?
I'll speak to my sergeant.
You do that, Curly grumbled. I got some people I can speak to myself. This is getting ridiculous.
Yes, sir.
Officer Delinko noticed that three portable latrines were strapped on the back of the flatbed truck. He caught himself smiling at the name painted on the blue doors. Travelin' Johnny.
For the construction crew, Curly explained. For when we get this project started. If we ever get it started.
Did you check them out? Asked the policeman.
Curly frowned.
The Johns? What for?
You never know.
Nobody in their right mind's gonna fool around with a toilet,
the foreman snorted.
Can I have a look? Officer Delinko asked.
Be my guest.
The policeman climbed up on the bed of the truck. From the outside, the portable latrines appeared untouched. The cargo straps were cinched tight, and the doors to all three units were closed. Officer Delinko opened one and peeked his head inside. The stall smelled heavily of disinfectant.
Well?
Curly called up to him.
A-okay, said the policeman.
Truth is, there ain't much to wreck on a porta-potty.
I suppose not.
Officer Delinko was about to shut the door when he heard a muffled noise. Was it a splash? The policeman stared uneasily at the blackness beneath the plastic seat. 10 seconds passed, then he heard it again. Definitely a splash.
What are you doing up there?
Curly demanded.
Listening,
replied Officer Delenko.
Listening to what?
Officer Delenko unclipped the flashlight from his belt. Edging forward, he aimed the light down the toilet hole. Curly heard a cry and watched in surprise as the policeman burst from the doorway of the latrine, leaping off the flatbed like an Olympic hurdler. What now? The foreman wondered unhappily. Officer Delenko picked himself off the ground and smoothed the front of his uniform. He retrieved his flashlight and tested it to make sure the bulb wasn't broken. Curly handed him his hat, which had come to rest near an owl burrow.
So? Let's hear it, the foreman said.
The policeman nodded grimly. Alligators, he declared.
You're kidding me.
I wish I was, said Officer Delenko. They put alligators in your potties, sir. Real live alligators.
More than one?
Yes, sir. Curly was flabbergasted.
Are they big gators?
Officer Delenko shrugged, nodding toward the traveling Johnnies. I imagine all of them look big, he said, when they're swimming under your butt. Miss Hennepin had notified Roy's mother, so he had to repeat the story when he got home from school, and once more when his father returned from work.
Why was this young man choking you? You didn't do something to provoke him, did you?
Asked Mr. Eberhardt. Roy says he picks on everybody, Mrs. Eberhardt said, but even so, fighting is never the right thing.
It wasn't a fight, Roy insisted. I only punched him to make him let go. Then I got off the bus and ran.
And that's when you were struck by the golf ball? His father asked, wincing at the thought. He ran a long, long way, his mother said.
Roy sighed. I was scared.
He didn't like lying to his parents, but he was too worn out to explain the real reason that he had run so far. Mr. Eberhardt examined the bruise over his son's ear.
You took a nasty shot here. Maybe Dr. Schulman ought to have a look.
No, Dad, I'm okay.
The paramedics had checked him out on the golf course, and the school nurse at Trace Middle had spent 45 minutes observing him for signs of a possible concussion.
He seems to be fine, agreed Roy's mother. The other young man, however, has a broken nose.
Oh?
Mr. Eberhardt's eyebrows arched. To Roy's surprise, his father didn't seem angry. And while he wasn't exactly beaming at Roy, there was unmistakable affection, and possibly even pride, in his gaze. Roy thought it was a good opportunity to renew his plea for leniency.
Dad, he was strangling me. What else could I do?
What would you have done?
He pulled down his collar to display the bluish finger marks on his neck. Mr. Eberhardt's expression darkened.
Liz, did you see this?
He asked Roy's mother, who nodded fretfully.
Does the school know what that thug did to our son?
The vice principal does, Roy piped up. I showed her.
What did she do?
Suspended me from the bus for 2 weeks. Plus I have to write an apology.
What happened to the other boy? Wasn't he disciplined too?
I don't know, Dad.
Because this is assault, Mr. Eberhardt said.
You can't choke another person. It's against the law.
You mean they could arrest him?
Roy didn't want to get Dana Matherson thrown in jail, because then Dana's mean and equally large friends might come after him. Being the new kid in school, Roy didn't need to be making those types of enemies. His mother said,
Roy, honey, they're not going to arrest him, but he needs to be taught a lesson. He could seriously hurt somebody, picking on smaller kids the way he does.
Mr. Eberhardt sat forward intently.
What's the boy's name?
Roy hesitated. He wasn't sure exactly what his father did for a living, but he was aware it had something to do with law enforcement. Occasionally, when talking to Roy's mother, Mr. Eberhardt would refer to his working for the DOJ, which Roy had deciphered as the United States Department of Justice. As much as Roy disliked Dana Matherson, he didn't believe the kid was worthy of the U.S. government's attention. Dana was just a big, stupid bully. The world was full of them.
Roy, please tell me, his father pressed.
The boy's name is Matherson, Mrs. Eberhardt chimed in. Dana Matherson.
At first, Roy was relieved that his father didn't write the name down, hoping it meant that he wasn't going to pursue the incident. Then Roy remembered that his father seemed to have a supernatural memory. For instance, he could still recite the batting averages of the entire starting lineup for the 1978 New York Yankees.
Liz, you should call the school tomorrow,
Mr. Eberhardt said to Mrs. Eberhardt, and find out if and how this boy will be disciplined for attacking Roy.
First thing in the morning, Mrs. Eberhardt promised.
Roy groaned inwardly. It was his own fault that his parents were reacting so strongly. He should never have shown them the marks on his neck.
Mom, Dad, I'll be fine. Honest, I will. Can't we just let the whole thing drop?
Absolutely not, his father said firmly.
Your dad's right, said Roy's mother. This is a serious matter. Now come to the kitchen and let's put some ice on your bump. Afterwards, you can work on that apology letter.
On one wall of Roy's bedroom was a poster from the Livingston Rodeo that showed a cowboy riding a ferocious humpback bull. The cowboy held one hand high in the air, and his hat was flying off his head. Every night before turning off the lights, Roy would lie on his pillow and stare at the poster, imagining that he was the sinewy young bull rider in the picture. 8 or 9 seconds was an eternity on top of an angry bull, but Roy imagined himself hanging on so tightly that the animal couldn't shake him no matter how furiously it tried. The seconds would tick by until finally the bull would sink to its knees in exhaustion. Then Roy would calmly climb off, waving to the roaring crowd. That's how he played the scene in his mind. Maybe someday, Roy thought, hopefully, his father would be transferred back to Montana. Then Roy could learn to ride bulls like a cowboy. On the same wall of his bedroom was a yellow flyer handed out to drivers entering Yellowstone National Park. The flyer said, "Warning! Many visitors have been gored by buffalo. Buffalo can weigh 2,000 pounds and can sprint at 30 miles per hour, 3 times faster than you can run. These animals may appear tame, but are wild, unpredictable, and dangerous. Do not approach buffalo." At the bottom of the handout was a drawing of a tourist being tossed on the horns of a fuming bison. The tourist's camera was flying one way, and his cap was flying another, just like the cowboy's hat in the rodeo poster. Roy had saved the Yellowstone flyer because he was so amazed that anybody would be dumb enough to stroll up to a full-grown buffalo and snap its picture. Yet it happened every summer. And every summer, some nitwit tourist got gored. It was exactly the sort of idiotic stunt that Dana Matherson would try, Roy thought as he contemplated his apology letter. He could easily envision the big goon trying to hop on a bison like it was a carousel pony. Roy took a piece of lined notebook paper out of his English folder and wrote, "Dear Dana, I am sorry I busted your nose. I hope the bleeding has stopped. I promise not to hit you ever again as long as you don't bother me on the school bus. I think that's a fair arrangement. Most sincerely, Roy A. Eberhardt." He took the page downstairs and showed his mother, who frowned slightly.
"Honey, it seems a little too, well, forceful."
"What do you mean, Mom?"
"It's not the content of the letter so much as the tone."
She handed it to Roy's father, who read it and said, "I think the tone is exactly right, but you better look up arrangement in the dictionary." The police captain slumped at his desk. This wasn't how he planned to end his career. After 22 winters pounding the streets of Boston, he'd moved to Florida with the hope of 5 or 6 warm, uneventful years before retirement. Coconut Cove had sounded ideal, yet it had turned out not to be the sleepy little village that the captain had envisioned. The place was growing like a weed. Too much traffic, too many tourists, and yes, even crime. Not nasty big city crime, but flaky Florida-style crime. "How many?" he asked the sergeant. The sergeant looked at Officer Delenko, who said, "Total of 6.
2 in each toilet?"
"Yes, sir."
"How big?"
"The largest was 4 feet even. The smallest was 31 inches, replied Officer Delenko, reading matter-of-factly from his report.
"Real alligators," the captain said.
"That's right, sir." Officer Delenko's sergeant spoke up.
"They're gone now, Captain. Don't worry. A reptile wrangler came and got him out of the Johns."
With a chuckle, he added,
"The little one almost took the guy's thumb off."
The captain said, "What's a reptile wrangler?"
"Ah, never mind. Believe it or not, we found him in the Yellow Pages."
"Figures," the captain muttered. Normally, an officer of his rank wouldn't get involved in such a silly case,
but the company building the pancake franchise had some clout with local politicians. One of Mother Paula's big shots had called Councilman Grandy, who immediately chewed out the police chief, who quickly sent word down the ranks to the captain, who swiftly called for the sergeant, who instantly summoned, last and least, Officer Delinko.
"What the heck's going on out there?" the captain demanded. "Why would kids single out this one construction site to vandalize?"
"Two reasons," said the sergeant. "Boredom and convenience. I'll bet you $5 it's juvies who live in the neighborhood." The captain eyed Officer Delinko. "What do you think?"
"It seems too organized to be kids, pulling out every stake, not just once, but twice.
Think about what happened today. How many kids do you know who could handle a 4-foot gator?" Officer Delinko said. "Seems awful risky for a practical joke."
"Delinko is no Sherlock Holmes," thought the police captain, "but he's got a point."
"Well then, let's hear your theory," he said to the patrolman.
"Yes, sir. Here's what I think," Officer Delinko said. "I think somebody's got it in for Mother Paula. I think it's some kind of a revenge deal."
"Revenge?" repeated the captain, somewhat skeptically.
"That's right," the patrolman said. "Maybe it's a rival pancake house."
The sergeant shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
"There is no other pancake house in Coconut Cove."
"Okay," said Officer Delinko, rubbing his chin. "So then, how about a disgruntled customer? Maybe someone who once had a bad breakfast at Mother Paula's."
The sergeant laughed.
"How can you mess up a flapjack?"
"I agree," the captain said. He'd heard enough. "Sergeant, I want you to send a patrol car by the construction site every hour."
"Yes, sir." "Either you catch these vandals or you scare them away. It doesn't matter to me as long as the chief isn't getting any more phone calls from Councilman Bruce Grandy. Clear?"
As soon as they left the captain's office, Officer Delinko asked his sergeant if he could come in early to work the Mother Paula patrol.
"No way, David. The overtime budget's tapped out."
"Oh, I don't want any overtime," the patrolman said.
All he wanted was to solve the mystery. 4. Roy's mother made him stay home all weekend to make sure there was no delayed reaction to the golf ball bonking. Though his head felt fine, he didn't sleep well either Saturday night or Sunday night. On the way to school Monday morning, his mother asked what was bothering him. Roy said it was nothing, which wasn't true. He was worried about what would happen when Dana Matherson caught up with him. But Dana was nowhere to be seen at Trace Middle.
"Called in sick," Garrett reported.
He claimed to have inside information, owing to his mother's high-ranking position as a guidance counselor.
"Dude, what'd you do to that poor guy? I heard there was guts all over the bus."
"That's not true.
I heard you pounded him so hard, his nose got knocked up to his forehead. I heard he'll need plastic surgery to put it back where it belongs."
Roy rolled his eyes.
"Yeah, right."
Garrett made a fart noise through his teeth.
"Hey, everybody in school's talking about this, talking about you, Eberhardt."
"Great." They were standing in the hall after homeroom, waiting for the first period bell. Garrett said,
"Now they think you're a tough guy."
"Who does? Why?" Roy didn't want to be thought of as tough. He didn't particularly want to be thought of at all. He just wanted to blend in quietly and not be noticed, like a bug on a riverbank.
"They think you're tough," Garrett went on. "Nobody's ever slugged a Matherson before."
Apparently Dana had three older brothers, none of whom was remembered fondly at Trace Middle.
"What'd you put in your apology letter? Dear Dana, I'm sorry I thumped you. Please don't break every bone in my body. Leave me one good arm so at least I can feed myself."
"You're so funny," Roy said dryly. The truth was, Garrett was pretty funny.
"What do you think that gorilla's gonna do next time he sees you?" he said to Roy. "I was you, I'd start thinking about plastic surgery myself so that Dana wouldn't recognize me. Seriously, man."
"Garrett, I need a favor."
"What, a place to hide? Try the South Pole."
The bell rang and streams of students filled the hall. Roy pulled Garrett aside.
"There's a tall girl with curly blonde hair. She wears red glasses."
Garrett looked alarmed.
"Don't tell me."
"Tell you what?
You got the hots for Beatrice Leap?"
"That's her name?"
Roy figured it had been at least 100 years since anyone had named their daughter Beatrice. No wonder she was such a sorehead.
"What do you know about her?" he asked Garrett.
"I know enough to stay out of her way. She's a major soccer jock," Garrett said, "with a major attitude. I can't believe you've got the hots for her.
I don't even know her," Roy protested. "She's hacked off at me for some crazy reason, and I'm just trying to figure out why."
Garrett groaned. "First Dana Matherson, now Beatrice the Bear? You got a death wish, Tex?"
"Tell me about her. What's her story?"
"Not now. We're going to be late for class."
"Come on," Roy said. "Please."
Garrett stepped closer, checking nervously over his shoulder. "Here's all you need to know about Beatrice Leap," he said in a whisper. "Last year, one of the star linebackers for Graham High snuck up from behind and slapped her on the bottom. This was at the Big Cypress Mall, broad daylight. Beatrice chased the guy down and heaved him into the fountain. Broke his collarbone in 3 places, out for the season."
"No way," said Roy.
"Maybe you ought to think about Catholic school."
Roy gave a hollow laugh. "Too bad we're Methodists."
"Then convert, dude," Garrett said.
"Seriously."
Officer David Delinko looked forward to getting up early to scout the construction site. It was a welcome break from his daily routine, which offered few opportunities for real surveillance. Usually that was left to the detectives. Although Officer Delinko liked the town of Coconut Cove, he had become bored with his job, which mostly involved traffic enforcement. He had joined the police force because he wanted to solve crimes and arrest criminals, yet except for the occasional drunk driver, Officer Delinko rarely got to lock up anybody. The handcuffs clipped to his belt were as shiny and unscratched as the day he had joined the force, almost 2 years earlier. Vandalism and trespassing weren't big-time crimes, but Officer Delinko was intrigued by the continuing pattern of mischief at the future site of Mother Paula's All-American Pancake House. He had a hunch that the culprit, or culprits, intended something more serious than juvenile pranks. Since the police chief was getting pressure to stop the incidents, Officer Delinko knew that catching the vandals would be a feather in his cap, and possibly the first step toward a promotion. His long-term career goal was to become a detective, and the Mother Paula case was a chance to show he had the right stuff. On the first Monday after the alligator episode, Officer Delinko set his alarm clock for 5 a.m. He rolled out of bed, took a quick shower, toasted himself a bagel, and headed out for the construction site. It was still dark when he arrived. 3 times he circled the block and saw nothing unusual. Except for a garbage truck, the streets were empty. The police radio was quiet as well. Not much happened in Coconut Cove before dawn. Or after dawn, for that matter, Officer Delinko mused. He parked the squad car next to Leroy Brannett's work trailer and waited for the sun to rise. It promised to be a pretty morning. The sky looked clear, with a rim of pink in the east. Officer Delinko wished he'd brought a thermos of coffee, because he wasn't accustomed to getting up so early. Once he caught himself sagging behind the steering wheel, so he slapped briskly at his cheeks in order to stay awake. Peering through the fuzzy early morning gray, Officer Delinko thought he saw movement in the open field ahead of him. He flicked on the squad car's headlights, and there on a grassy mound, marked by a freshly planted survey stake, stood a pair of burrowing owls. Curly hadn't been kidding. These were the dinkiest owls that Officer Delinko had ever seen, only 8 or 9 inches tall. They were dark brown with spotted wings, whitish throats, and piercing amber eyes. Officer Delinko wasn't a bird watcher, but he was intrigued by the toy-sized owls. For several moments, they stared at the car, their big eyes blinking uncertainly. Then they took off, chattering to each other as they swooped low over the scrub. Hoping he hadn't scared the birds away from their nest, Officer Delinko turned off his headlights. He rubbed his heavy eyelids and propped his head against the inside of the car window. The glass felt cool against his skin. A mosquito buzzed around his nose, but he was too sleepy to swipe at it. Soon he nodded off, and the next thing he heard was the radio crackle of the dispatcher's voice, routinely asking for his location. Officer Delinko fumbled for the microphone and recited the address of the construction site. 10-4,
the dispatcher said, signing off.
Officer Delenko gradually roused himself. The squad car was hot, but oddly, it looked darker outside now than when he'd first arrived. So dark, in fact, that he couldn't see anything, not even the construction.